This is Story Behind the Story. I'm your host, Clara Shirley Appel. My guest today is the local author and philosopher, Ted Siegel. Ted retired from his career as an academic administrator in late 2019 after wrestling with extreme stress, burnout, and PTSD, caused, in part, by the conditions of work as it is formulated today. He wrote Signs of the Great Refusal, The Coming Struggle for a Post-Work Society, in part to understand and process his own experiences, and more broadly, to understand and work through what it was about contemporary work that felt so untenable and unsustainable. Throughout the book, Ted leans into his background as a political philosopher. He attended the PhD program in philosophy at the New School, grounding his understanding of work as we know it in the political and economic critiques of capital going back to Marx in the 19th century, putting them into dialogue with political understandings of work and labor in the 20th century from Arendt and others. The result is an exploration not only of the role and function of work in contemporary society, but what it might take to build a post-work politics out of the nascent anti-work movements alive today. Ted Siegel, welcome to Story Behind the Story.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really, really excited to be here.
Well, I'm really excited for this interview. And I wanted to start, of course, by just asking you, what is the great refusal? What does it mean to refuse work in the present age?
I came up with this term, first of all, work as we know it, mm-hmm. which is, it's meant to refer to the condition of wage labor today under post-Fordist neoliberal capitalism in the digital age. And it's something that gets unpacked sort of across the book. But to put it in a political context, I wanted to situate the story about a possible movement of struggle in relationship mm-hmm. to working conditions. And I wanted to ground it in something like an American experience of resistance to domination. And so
right.
I was thinking a lot about Marcuse and the student movements of the 60s and was rereading Marcuse because I wanted to try to situate it in relationship to intersectional politics of identity. I wanted to be able to say that this kind of a sort of contemporary take on labor that's non-traditional from the point of view of a politics of class can be complementary with work that's done around identitarian struggles. And the term, or rather the thing that was so compelling was I found this line in Marcuse in Essay on Liberation that said, the great refusal takes a variety of forms.
Right.
And I use that as the epigrammatic, you know, quote for the book. And the idea is that, well, one of those forms can be explicit resistance or refusal of work. And in the time in which we're living, it occurred to me that, you know, we need to find our way back to forms of resistance that take the fight directly to capital accumulation.
You mentioned before the sort of concept of work as we know it. That's the term that you use throughout to describe work in the modern age. What does that term mean to you, and how do you characterize contemporary work?
It's a condition of wage labor under post-Fordist neoliberal capitalism in the digital age. And that's something I unpack in different ways across the book. After the front matter, I offer a provisional answer to the question of what is work today and what is the meaning of refusal in relation to it in the first two chapters. Mm-hmm. But to get there, I deployed this noun phrase, work as we know it. Ultimately, it's going to require an analysis of wage labor in the modern age in order to answer the question fully. But I basically say that it's something that's increasingly poorly distributed.
Mm.
People have either too little or too much. It's precarious. It's increasingly authoritarian.
Mm.
It can be arbitrary and purposeless. And it is really reliant on our personal biopower, which is to say our total life energies, our communication skills, our total personalities are required for the performance of increasingly immaterial labor. It's also very stressful for that reason.
Yeah.
And it's also something that, as we know today, watching AI unfold, that work may, as we know it, may be facing extinction.
I wanted to ask you, and especially because you sort of mentioned the role of AI, and you are yourself someone who has worked in Silicon Valley. What role do you think technology and the tech industry has played in shaping the character of work as it is?
You know, there are really huge upheavals happening in the world of work, as we know. And it's more than just layoffs, and it's more than the usual sort of grumblings about work-life balance, device fatigue, or post-pandemic remote work policies.
Yeah.
When I used to talk about post-work society before the arrival of AI, people would say that such a thing was either impossible, or if not, then something undesirable, full stop. They'd say it's impossible, the economy runs on work, there's no way to produce value without labor, and they'd invoke the work ethic and say that people need to work in order not to fall into vice, and weren't generally recognizing that work can mean something other than just the valorization of capital in profit-making enterprises. Mm. If they didn't see it then, they're seeing it now. Mm. And the reason is because a lot of the job loss we're seeing, and we're going to see a lot more, has to do with ways in which now it's possible to perform all kinds of otherwise human labor through technological dead labor. And it's becoming clear, like Elon Musk in the last week or so, or maybe actually it was in November, but it's been reported again, said that a time is going to come where there will be no jobs. AI is going to do everything. That's what he said. So the problem with work is not just job loss because of AI. We have all kinds of knowledge workers, the educated PMC, and increasingly all kinds of workers in the technological age that are starting to suffer from early forms of burnout. You know, I started looking at people my own age who were having to tap out in their 50s because there's just no way they were going to make it to 65. For a variety of reasons. And then I started seeing that people in their 30s and 40s are already showing the same signs. So I started thinking about a cross-generational experience of work that's kind of despairing. We're seeing very high rates of PTSD anxiety. And of course, we're still seeing, you know, at a cross-class level, what were called the deaths of despair among people in rural areas where there's job loss, people who are underemployed. This has been going on since the 70s and 80s, and it's also helped to fuel the radical right. But since the 2008 crash, I think that you can contextualize what's happening with work in terms of a kind of increasingly radicalized neoliberalism that's playing itself out. You know, the hallmark of a radicalized neoliberalism is the effects it's creating are being weaponized. And so there's a kind of a doubling down on the negative societal effects of that mode of governmentality. This is in the context of a story that's been told to people for 100 years about how technology, you know, was going to eventually lead to a condition where we would work less and with less intensity.
So you mentioned just a second ago that Elon Musk quote and the sort of brief description of AI, the sort of idea that, like, AI might make it so that there are no workers ever.
Yeah.
Personally, I think that's a little off the mark, but what it does remind me of, and I think you have some discussion of this in the book, is Marx's commentary on workers becoming machine miners.
Yes.
I'm wondering if you could speak to that a little bit, about how you see that operating in the digital age.
Again, Marx is fairly gloomy about automation, but there's a strain of open Marxism or post-Marxism that says, well, you know, we have the benefit of 150 years. We can actually see that there are potentials for what some philosophers call subjectification rather than subjection. And what that means is that technology, particularly in the realm of the social, in the realm of what he calls the general intellect, creates possibilities for people to refashion themselves in the ways that they want to toward personal autonomy, collective sort of realization of ideas of emancipation and freedom. And so there's a tension there because, you know, there's a lot of critique of immaterial labor theory, like, well, what is it anyway? And blah, blah, blah. But I think we're at a moment where the question of what is value is a real serious question. I mean, tech workers benefited for a long time from the immateriality of their work. They were basically treated like pinball wizards who went off and did whatever they did. There was no way of monitoring how much time it took them to do anything. And as long as the app came out and it worked and it got through QA, everyone was happy. But there's a real question today about if you have a society that's based on the wage and exchange value, what is value going to mean anymore if everything is being produced without human labor time? At one level, you could say, well, this has great potential because, you know, we would like to see human labor time to be liberated,
what is it?
Right?
fully automated luxury case-based communism.
Yes, and that's a wonderful example of a utopian counterfactual, you know, but with great seriousness about why can't it be like this, you know? And so, I mean, my hero in the book is actually Paolo Virno, who I really like, another theorist you can look up, but he gives a remarkable account of how these resources, again, very theoretical, very philosophical, but it points in a direction of how people could essentially enable and be enabled by technology for projects of emancipation rather than...
to be machine mindless.
Yeah, and under the context of some sort of techno-neo-feudalist dystopia.
Monday evenings at 6 p.m. on K-Squid. Tune in for an hour of locally produced talk programs created by women featuring in-depth explorations of our inner and outer worlds.
On first and third Mondays, Moment of Truth with Amy Chen Mills takes a look at the current state of our planet and nation with leading activists and thinkers on essential topics, as well as experts for our own resiliency and spiritual and emotional grounding during these challenging times.
Every second Monday, tune in for State of Mind with Deborah Sloss, featuring intimate conversations about mental health and wellness. Join us for new understandings, seeds of hope, and valuable resources.
Every fourth Monday at 6, you'll hear The Babblery with Suki Wessling. The Babblery features conversations with and about women in the 21st century, working, parenting, playing, voting, advocating, and creating as women.
Women created, women led programs about our inner and outer worlds. Every Monday, 6 to 7 p.m. on KSQD, streaming and available as podcasts on ksqd.org.
State of Mind.
Moment of Truth with Amy Chen Mills.
And The Babblery.
If you're just joining me, my guest today is author Ted Siegel, whose book, Signs of the Great Refusal, asks what it might take to deprivatize and repoliticize work as we know it. Can I ask us to move a little bit? Because I'm curious how you see these kinds of, both the sort of characteristics that you outlined of what work as we know it is, and the way that sort of leaders and the technology that they're sort of employing get weaponized to make it harder. What relationship do you see all of that having to the kinds of barriers that exist currently to developing the kind of true post-work politics that you're interested in? How is the contemporary or the character of contemporary work itself creating or contributing to those barriers?
There are 2.8 million people on the anti-work subreddit, okay?
Wow.
And what they do there is they complain, okay? They complain about their bosses. They complain about their coworkers. They complain about the labor market. And from what I can tell, if you introduce politics on the subreddit, they will immediately quarantine your post. At least that's what happened to me, okay? And it's meant to be a place where... you know, it's again for a neoliberal self to
convention, forget it.
Yes, and it's for an individual response. If you start to reflect on collective action, that's a completely different thing. You know, I give you an example about how deeply this is ingrained in the Valley. Okay, I observed a conversation where someone was talking about, you know, a set of issues, and this was recently, and what they said was, the way they framed their answer or exploration was to say, well, that thing, whatever it was, that's the macro, okay? That's the macro environment. But what we need to do is focus on what we can do and find solutions, right? And so there's a bracketing. And again, this is neoliberal 1A, which is that we sort of deify the market, it decides, and then it's up to us as middle managers and technologists and whatever else to come up with clever solutions so that we can live interstitially like rats. I mean, I don't want to be that bitter, but there's a lot of sort of subtle self-censorship that goes on because people have jobs that require them to be productive around any issue, to find a solution, to work on how we can monetize, how we can make profit, how can we put a positive face on whatever it is that's happening. You know, when Jared Kushner says there's great real estate, you know, in Gaza, you know, that's the same mentality.
So how do you, not to skip directly solutions in this, but how do you get around that? How do you move past that mentality, that attitude, when it is so pervasive?
Unfortunately, there's something even more pernicious going on that's part of this radicalization before I answer that.
Sure.
Which is, this radicalization is playing itself out in the pronouncements of tech moguls. We just had the Hayekian techno-feudalist manifesto by Marc Andreessen come out a couple of weeks ago. And a New York Times columnist wrote that it has the pathos of the Unabomber manifesto, but lacks the ideological coherency. And Washington Post called it a self-serving cry for help. So I think something is changing, which is that Silicon Valley tech bros or tech moguls are not going to be allowed to define the meaning of technology and society for the rest of us anymore. I think that's jumped the shark, as they used to say, you know, in the 90s, that something has changed where the valley doesn't get to tell us the meaning of the valley.
Okay? Why do you think that is?
I think that as part of the billionaire class, there's been a kind of radicalization of these moguls. Okay. So we're starting to see, I mean, we're seeing other things happening, which is the kind of people who used to support liberal causes, people like Omidyar, Hewlett Foundation, are now apparently contributing to American Compass, which is associated with a MAGA Project 2025. This has been reported on by Jeet Heer and by Jane Mayer. And I think that if you look at, like, we're in an interesting moment. So, like, when Kara Swisher's book comes out, Burn Book, you know, it appears, I mean, I haven't had a chance to read it, but from what I can tell, it's mostly a series of anecdotes where she sort of flames the tech bros that she knows because they turned out to be sort of garden variety billionaire creeps rather than utopian futurist humanitarians that they had claimed to be. So I guess my answer to your question through this lens is that there needs to be more serious analysis that has to break through in the skeptical coverage of what's going on out there. So, you know, again, I haven't read her book, but there doesn't seem to be any serious analysis of contemporary forms of cloud rent and the enclosure of digital commons. There doesn't seem to be any broader understanding of how this is really reshaping the global economy. So I have in mind things like Yanis Varoufakis' recent book, Techno-Feudalism. I'm not seeing, you know, analysis of how big data-driven personalization, polarization has broken our politics. But I think it's important that we question very limited techno-skepticism, you know. So maybe it should be called the Sunburn Book, you know, instead of the Burn Book. So I was also thinking about a recent interview with Cory Doctorow, who coined the term enchantification. And in response to continual enchantification, he says, of cloud-based apps and services, we should seek to alter the deal. Okay, well, what does he mean by that? I heard this in an interview. He says there should be a set of regulatory consequences for enchantifying your apps. And as consumers, we should demand platform interoperability in order to restore competition, to hold platform providers accountable for enchantification. I mean, I just think we need to move to a stronger, more political form of critique. First of all, capitalism enchantifies everything, including your local healthcare, in case you haven't noticed. You know, it pursues profit rather than satisfaction of human needs. And for a while, it can appear as if these two vectors are moving in the same direction. But after a while, you can't pretend to be doing both anymore. So enchantification is a truth about capitalism. It's about the conflict between use values and exchange values, between meeting needs and valorizing capital. And so the question is, why can't we broaden out the digital age critique?
We're going to take a short break. When we return, I'll ask Ted to read a short excerpt from Signs of the Great Refusal. We're back with Ted Siegel, author of Signs of the Great Refusal. Ted, I think now would be a good time to have you read from the book. Before you start, could you tell us a little bit about the section you're going to read?
So this section is from the introduction. And I cover a lot of different ground in the introduction, but this section is called The Great Refusal as the Deep Grammar of the New Left. And so this is an elaboration on something we were talking about at the beginning about, you know, how do you situate this sort of a political project in the history of American forms of resistance, things like that.
Great. Thank you.
It should be pointed out that the term The Great Refusal comes to us from Herbert Marcuse as part of his early and influential attempt across several books to theorize the general significance of what came to be called the New Left in the 60s. The Great Refusal, this generally refers to the aggregate social movements of resistance against advanced capitalist forms of domination that operate in the absence of any discernible revolutionary working class consciousness. Nonetheless, Marcuse tends to be remembered first and foremost as the philosophical guru of the youth counterculture because he was able to grasp in a theoretical form what has been referred to as the deep grammar of the movement. As Winnie Brenes pointed out about the notion of the Great Refusal back in the late 80s, Marcuse recognized that political demands are different from political goals and that therefore the issue is not the issue. At the surface level, the New Left and the counterculture were organized around certain issues that gave the movement its impetus. But Brenes says that the American student movement of the 60s was about the necessity of revolt. Students wished to create a world turned upside down. As I read an essay on liberation once again after many years, there are several things that tend to stand out as wildly optimistic from the perspective of contemporary experience. For example, there is Marcuse's hopeful view that the spread of a surrealist form of protest and refusal in the 60s was enacting a kind of a Kantian contest of the faculties carried out in the streets. Marcuse proposed that this supposed liberation of the productive imagination might come to direct science and technology as such in a utopian direction, that is, as deployments of human energies that would give substance to Nietzsche's notions of a gaia scientia and a transvaluation of values. His related claim that the psychedelic experience actually represented a related search for a new sensorium, a revolution in perception, has not aged terribly well either. Also problematic today, even on its face, is the notion that the working class, understood as the traditional industrial proletariat, somehow remains the historical agent of revolution and as such is in itself, even though it has come to share the counter-revolutionary needs of the middle classes and so is not yet for itself. The displacement of most industrial manufacturing away from the developed world belies the need to continue to rethink the meaning of labor and work under post-Fordist neoliberal capitalist conditions. In a related vein, Marcuse would need to be updated in order to account for how crisis-prone capitalism has become, to register the effects of increasing inequality, and to theorize the diversity of new forms of domination that have emerged. But what continued to be relevant, for lack of any better option, is the notion that there is an immediate need to loosen the hold of enslaving needs created by the exploitative power of corporate capitalism, even if, as Marcuse says, the search for other specific historical agents of revolutionary change in the advanced capitalist countries is indeed meaningless. Marcuse's legacy in this domain resides in his having been the first to theoretically situate the emancipatory potential of the prefigurative politics of non-working class cultural forms of resistance, and thus also the successive waves of new social movements and identity politics thereafter. The happening of this kind of revolt, he says, signals the need for Marxism to rethink utopian politics. Utopian should no longer be taken to mean that which has no place, but rather should mean that which is blocked from coming about by the power of established society.
Thank you for reading that. So I just want to say this also sets up the next section of this is where you start talking about that quote. I think it's where that quote is that you mentioned at the beginning about Marcuse talking about the sort of plethora of different ways
yes.
that things need to be.
Variety of forms.
Variety of forms. Right. Thank you.
Yeah.
And also in that section, in addition to the sort of student movements that get laid out here, there's a description of Marcuse's legacy
in relation to some of the spontaneous revolts of the last couple of decades, the Arab Spring, Gilets Jaunes, yes. Occupy movement, Ferguson's Black Lives Matter protests. I'm interested in the sort of interplay that Marcuse has and that you mm-hmm. might see between the kind of prefigurative politics,
yeah.
the sort of those sorts of movements, the kind of pre-politics that you mentioned as far as the like anti-work subreddit and some yeah. of those other explicitly apolitical, even though they are sort of largely dealing with yeah. political concerns. What do you see as the sort of interplay between those things and a more mature politics of refusal?
I obviously think that they are complementary. I think we've reached a point where you could say, I mean, there's obviously a lot of terrible things going on to DEI around the world, or rather around the country. And, you know, there are some legitimate criticisms, I think, of the way DEI has been institutionally deployed.
Yeah.
I think that the aims are important and worthy. And what's happening in terms of rollback should tell us something about whether or not, essentially, whether a kind of a prefigurative politics can give us the kind of traction we need if it's divorced from, you know, a critique of capital or sort of politics of class. And so there's, how can I put this? There's a sense in which the way in which corporate environments adopted, you know, DEI and other things is an indicator that it was not considered to be a terrible threat to their bottom line.
Right.
That these searches were gradualist. So I think that, you know, I don't want to go too far with this because, again, I'm not opposed to that kind of work. But I think what you have to recognize is that it's about a search for equity within existing, you know, structures.
Yeah.
Fundamentally. It's a search for that kind of justice, yeah.
And I think part of why you're seeing all these rollbacks is because exactly as you said, I think corporations, you know, these big corporations didn't see DEI as a threat. They thought they could sort of institutionalize it in a way that would allow them to still sort of continue to meet their goals and they could sort of control it. And I think some of these rollbacks are a response to seeing, yes, there are some ways in which this could sort of be co-opted and used to yeah. suit the broader purpose of the company. But once you institute it, you have created a vector for pushback on those same sorts of things.
Right.
So now it is seen as a threat.
Right. And so I look at timescales that are available to us. I look at, when I think about reforming or transforming politics, I think about what kind of timescales are left to us to make radical changes. And so I go down the road of kind of generational politics because
right.
I don't think there's much time left. And so if it's not a generational politics that's somehow cross-class and across a number of different markers of identity, then what is it going to be, you know?
Right.
So, and it's not to downplay the fact that there are powerful activist voices from every living generation that's on the planet right now. But by the same token, there's a moment where a generation matures and settles in and focuses on making a living and whatever. And there's a limited window to make major generational, you know, shift in our politics. And I see signs that, that such a thing might be possible. So, and I also have a fairly complex analysis of how class politics and generational politics can be made to dovetail, which I can't get
yeah.
into here really in great detail.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
And I think we don't have to get into it in
yeah.
great detail, but I do just want to sort of give a little, I guess, primer or translation for the audience that when you talk about generational politics, right, my understanding is that you're setting up the generation versus just, say, the working class
right.
as the unit of change making.
Right.
So I'm interested in that in part because, right, historically, I think the generation has been looked at as something that
yeah.
it's not real, right?
Right?
It's the sort of figment of our imagination.
Right.
How do you, like, what do you see as the sort of reality that what sort of constitutes it as a reality that can then make it into a workable unit of change?
So I have two or three answers to that in short form. I mean, one of them is that the generational change taking place right now is of a different order than what has occurred in the past, where generations come and go and, you know, they sort of dance upon the stage for a very short period of time and they're replaced. And also, you know, youth cultures are fleeting, you know, but I think that what's different now is you have a generation or a couple of generations that are, you know, coming online as workers who recognize that we may be facing imminent climate catastrophe. We know we're facing imminent climate catastrophe within their lifespan. And I think that this creates a kind of a break. And I think that that there's a kind of radical change in consciousness that comes with that for both good and ill, you know, and has certain potentials. So that's one thing. The second answer that I give has to do with technology, which is, you know, Marx refers to the general intellect, okay? The general intellect is the body of knowledge that exists outside books and outside people's heads that have powerful impacts on society. And now we have in the cloud, you know, the sort of realization of this idea. And the question is, you know, for Marx, it was gloomy, you know, but there are potentials for subjectification through this kind of technological change. There are ways that generations can reflect their own class composition, can understand who they are and what is happening to them, and be able to create action potentials that were never there before, potentially. And so that's how I think that you get a kind of dovetailing of generational politics and class politics, because if you reflect class composition in all of its myriad ways, both microanalysis and macro, if people are looking to understand who are we in society in relation to the economy, in relation to whatever else is going on, you begin the work of class recomposition by doing that. So I think that there's a dovetailing possible between generational politics and class politics in that way. So that's the farthest I could go with it.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
Hi, join me, Dr. Julio, Monday afternoons from 1 to 3 p.m. for Monday Masala, an eclectic and spicy musical mix guaranteed to nourish your soul.
You know, I speak very, very fluent Spanish. Todo está bien, chévere.
Spend your Monday night at the opera on KSQD Santa Cruz. You'll hear the world's greatest singers tell some of the world's most powerful, romantic, funny, and unforgettable stories, all set to the most glorious music ever composed. It's all about drama and being a diva. Monday night at the opera, 7 to 10 p.m. on KSQD Santa Cruz 90.7 FM.
If you're just joining me, my guest today is author Ted Siegel, whose book, Signs of the Great Refusal, asks what it might take to deprivatize and repoliticize work as we know it. I was also interested in, this is maybe a little bit related, there's a discussion in part three of the book where you start talking about the destruction of the public sphere, and you get into this sort of Arendt and sort of Habermas discussion about public versus private. What I'm curious about is what you see, what relationship you see between the collapse of public life and the problems we see with work, and how that plays into developing a politics of refusal.
Yeah, I come at it a couple of different ways. I mean, the way I start the third part of the book is to say, how are we asked by the dominant culture to react to what is happening to us in the workplace? And the popular literature does one of two things generally. It either tells you ways you should lean in and become more efficient and effective and a better human capital, or else it tells you should seek certain forms of palliative care, mindfulness, you should raise bees.
Massages,
whatever. And, you know, the book was really motivated by the notion there has to be another option between these two things. And so, but then when you start thinking about, well, what are the forms of sort of self-renewal that are available to us that are not highly individualized or are not related to becoming, you know, more profit making, you know, and the answer to that is that they're blocked by the fact that we have a highly diminished experience of the public sphere. We feel disempowered, like there's no venue, there's no platform, there's no place for politics to happen. And so I start out by looking at that as, okay, what is the meaning of the collapse or dissolution of the public sphere? And I run through a kind of an argument between Arendt and Habermas about that. And I find this thing in Habermas that I found very interesting about what he calls the occupational pseudo-public sphere. It's sort of like at the tail end of the collapse of the public sphere, the last version of it that's pale is the occupational public sphere.
Yeah, so work pretending to be a third place.
So we all invest in work and all our life energies that are not involved with home and family and people we love is invested somehow in the workplace. And we literally have no time in which to do anything else, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, go ahead.
It's so interesting thinking about that in relationship to the like Silicon Valley campus, right? Where, it is a very intentional strategy, and you can hear CEOs talking about this, to make work as sort of homey an environment as possible, to create, you know, you have the gym, you have the restaurants, you have access to massages and to haircuts and someone to do your laundry.
Perfect.
Yeah. And that's always framed as sort of a way to get people to, you know, oh, you know, we're making it easier for people so they can be more productive. But it has this other effect too, where it takes these things that used to be in the public sphere and privatizes them and has them run by work.
Right.
So I think it's really interesting going back to that question, that discussion we had earlier about the sort of relationship between technology and the tech industry and these sorts of trends, to see that like...
And there's the discussion I have in there about capitalist spirituality.
Yes, which absolutely.
Is very much apropos of the same issue. And
Do you want to recap a little bit of that? Just give the like
short
overview.
Sure. I mean, you know, if you look at, there's a variety of things that are going on in sort of neoliberal work culture that has to do with these ways that you're supposed to take care of yourself that are very specific to being the kind of person who can be maximally productive in the knowledge economy. And so I kind of provide an analysis to a reading of a number of different books of how there's kind of a bricolage of these things that are all put together, but what they really represent is a kind of an ideology that fits within a certain notion of neoliberal productivity. And so I critique that. And I'm careful, you know, obviously people get real important, lasting, you know, personal benefits from doing these things, from engaging in various forms of therapy or self-care or whatever. I'm not literally denigrating them, but I'm pointing out that, first of all, they're not politics.
Right, they are personal benefits.
Right, and I have this section where I talk about the three orders of human suffering. I don't know if you remember that section or not. But
not off the top of my head.
But I talk about how that these kinds of personal projects, you know, sort of resolve to one level of human suffering. And there are multiple other levels that it can't touch by sort of definition. But, you know, where I end up going with that is I ask the question about what would be the nature of self-renewal as something other than wellness or recovery or something like that? What if, and the answers that come up are, from a sociological point of view, much more collective than individual. And then you ask, well, why can't we have these nice things? You know, and I talk about some trends in social psychology where, you know, people repeatedly say, we've done the math. I mean, we would save so much money if we did preventative care and we had social, you know, psychology programs and, you know, community-based programs and all of this. And look at, we do these trends and we save vast amounts of money instead of doing what we're doing now by providing, you know, care for people in crisis everywhere and medication and all this other stuff. And even these people realize through their own, you know, these are people working in psychology fields and they have a certain frame, but they realize that the answer to their own question about why they can't get any traction from government or from the corporate sector for their ideas is because we have a society that's already committed to a very high level of human casualty.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so if you have that in the background, where I end up going is I say there's a literature that emerges after this discussion of collapse of public sphere about the establishment of counterpublics, mm-hmm. which is what does it mean? So the whole question of exit, of exodus, yeah. what does it mean to walk away from a kind of society that was created by capital to begin with and that capital is already walking away from itself?
Yeah.
They don't want to pay the overhead. They want to pay the taxes. They don't want to
deal with the environmental
right. So if capital is exiting the kind of society of the wage-based society, if it's walking away from any sort of ideal of full employment or whatever else, and you know, what would it mean for you know, collectivities of people to seek an exit as well, right? And so the idea of a counterpublic is the idea of creating alternative, you know, public space. And if you want an example,
actually, if you don't mind my asking, sure. So one of the questions I have about how to put these ideas together is if we're aiming for a generational politics and the sort of hope, the great white hope in that sense is two generations that have largely been raised in the height of all of these, all of these sort of changes, all of these ways in which sort of late stage capitalism has taken its, you know, really taken root. And that includes things like the absence of a real public sphere. How do those generations start to build something that they have never seen before?
It's a really good question. I mean, if you look at the kind of most successful, wildly successful counterpublic, the most wildly successful, you know, counterpublic in our time, it's basically, you know, MAGA, okay? And it's got it's got huge funding backers, right? So the success with which these people created their own bubble, their own reality, and evacuated the, you know, dominant sort of cultural space for virtually half the country is remarkable, right? But it took a lot of money, a lot of technology, think tanks. It was very strategic, actually, you know. And it's always a case on the left that, you know, by definition, the left has no money. So it's like, but I believe that, you know, I give one concrete example at the end of the book, which is in Italy in the 1970s.
And I look Operismo.
At... Yeah, Operismo. And I look at... Okay, here's a group of people. This is the one time a mass politics of refusal is actually tried in the developed world in the latter half of the 20th century. And you have all of these people, young people, who are taken out from all over Italy and Southern Europe and placed in these factories in sort of Northern Italy coming out of World War II. And they're told that, you know, village life as they knew it is over and they're just factory workers now. And not only do they agitate for better working conditions, they say, we don't want to live like this, literally.
Yeah.
And there's a new kind of politics that begins to emerge. And so I kind of lay out what's going on, what happened, and what lessons can be learned from that experience. Obviously, it would have to be updated for the digital age. And there are some serious problems with what happened there, and the people who were involved in it, you know, provide mea culpas as well. But it's an interesting case study.
Yeah. In any case. Well, thank you so much. We are almost out of time, but I do want to ask what you're working on now. What's next for you?
So interesting. You know, I'm writing two books. It wasn't enough to write the next book, but there are two questions for me that came out of this. And one of them has to do with, you know, in asking the question, what kind of politics, I end up talking toward the end of the book about Hart and Negri and autonomia. And I'm interested in sort of ideas of radical republicanism drawn from the early modern period, that if we're living in the twilight of liberalism, what options are there than trying to capture the state, essentially, right?
Yeah.
You know, particularly it's not going to end well if we try that anyway. But and so I'm interested in following a number of disparate thinkers from different intellectual traditions converging on a certain idea. And then the other one has to do with sort of zombie capitalism, which is I'm actually rereading Capital around technical issue around the value form problem. And I'm trying to understand, you know, why it is that capitalism has such a stranglehold on culture, on society,
right,
even when it's already something highly spectral and it's questionable whether we're even living in an age of capitalism already. And so I'm trying to philosophically understand what the roots of that are in my other project.
Ted Siegel, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you for having me. It was really delightful and I appreciate all your interest.
You can learn more about Ted at his website, tedsiegel.com. That's Ted with two D's and then S-E-I-G-E-L. At that website, you can also find a link to purchase Signs of the Great Refusal. Catch Story Behind the Story the first Friday of every month from 5 to 6 p.m. on KSQD 90.7 FM. To share your thoughts on this or other shows, drop me a line at clara@ksqd.org. The Story Behind the Story is produced and edited for KSQD 90.7 FM by me, Clara Shirley Appel. Our mixing engineer is Lanier Sammons. He also wrote our theme.